Parsha of Sota, because it demands a little bit of a rethink. A couple of years ago, we talked about Sota, and at the time, I suggested one of the possibilities of what Sota is all about. But let's just kind of walk through the case and see what it is that we understand is happening, what we assume is happening in the case of Sota. So what's the context? There's a husband, a wife, and what does the husband think? She's having an affair, right? He thinks she's having an affair. Does he have evidence to it? Yeah, circumstantial, but not direct evidence, not direct testimony. Okay.
With him seeing it being enough, becomes, by the way?
No. And he becomes jealous. Yeah, has to be, and not him. He can't be a witness to it. He's
right.
A scar.
Right.
So there's no proper testimony to it, and yet there's circumstantial evidence. And so he brings his wife to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, let's play this out. Whatever happens if she's guilty is going to be physically unpleasant, at least, if not fatal. We don't know. But it's going to be really bad. So what does he feel about her when he's bringing her to the Beit HaMikdash?
Not happy.
No, but what does he feel about her? I understand he's feeling not happy. He must either really dislike her enough
right. That
he's willing to risk her life for this. This guy's something motivating him, because if a guy loves his wife and thinks maybe she had an affair but can't prove it, and since legally they can continue to live together because there's no evidence to it, they don't need to break up the marriage, then and they want to make up, they'll figure out a way to make up. You know, go to a therapist and sell. There's no reason to not only destroy the marriage, but also to
so
potentially...
So in this case, it's somebody with two witnesses?
We're talking about where there's no witnesses, right? But he has suspicion because there's circumstantial evidence. There's a guy that he suspects...
I thought you need two witnesses to prove.
That's right, and there aren't. If there were, this wouldn't be happening. So they go to the...
With witnesses, you bypass the whole
subject. Yeah, there's no... It doesn't start. So you go, and it says, Ve'edein ba. So you go to the Beit HaMikdash, right? And then there's a ceremony that's done. And along with that ceremony, we'll go into the ceremony in a minute. Along with that ceremony, there's an oath that the Kohen administers to her, which in simplest terms says that if you indeed violated your marriage, then these waters that I'm going to give you to drink will come into you and will make your thigh fall and your stomach distend. I'm not sure what that means, but that's the words. And distend, I'm not even sure if that's proper translation. Just saying what it says. And then, on the other hand, if you have not violated it, then you will not be hurt in that way by this. Okay? And the woman has to say, Amen, Amen. In the meantime, before that, he has taken a kli, and he's filled it with water from the kior, and he's taken it afar, which we assume, of course, means dirt, from the floor of the Mishkan and put it in, and then he's written down that oath on a parchment, and then diluted that parchment, meaning the ink, into the drink, and then he gives her the drink, and she takes the drink, and then the text says the following, that if she's guilty, then the waters come in as bitter waters, and they curse her, and her thigh falls and her stomach, tsava, whatever that means, maybe distends, and she becomes a curse among her people. And if, on the other hand, she is not defiled, then she will be cleansed and she will then have seed. And that's the law. Now, the question is, what's happening here? In other words, how do we understand what this procedure is actually doing? So there is a whole school of thought, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a traditional school of thought, but there's certainly a school of thought that looks at this thing and looks at it as something that isn't really going to manifest itself, but is there for one of two possible motivations. One of them is simply a deterrent, because if enough people out there believe that if my husband gets jealous of me and I give him reason to be jealous, then I'm going to go through this and I could blow up or whatever is going to happen to me, then people will avoid doing bad stuff. Of course, deterrence never work for a simple reason, because nobody ever commits a crime when they think they're going to get caught. Right? That's why the death penalty, being instituted or not being instituted, has not in any way changed murder rates, because nobody who's going to commit murder thinks, oh, I'm going to get caught, but I don't mind if I only get life in prison, but I do mind getting killed. Nobody thinks that way. So deterrents don't necessarily work when they're that broad. The other thing is, and this is what we talked about 2 years ago, is that maybe the entire ceremony is really a mollification, meaning since there's no proof that she did it, there's no ironclad proof, And according to halacha, without ironclad proof, that's the end of it. Which means, really, we should just tell the guy, go home, live with your wife, make up with her. Or if you don't want to, divorce her. But stay. There's no witnesses, so there's nothing to do here. But the guy's so enraged, so to make him feel better and to do what we can to create the possibility of a rapprochement, we have him go through. We have her go through the ceremony, which, of course, is going to do nothing. That's the thought. And as a result of that, he'll see that she's not really guilty and he'll take her back, which, of course, means that if she really is guilty, well, we're going to do the wink-wink on that. So those are both kind of difficult approaches, but they're approaches that have been suggested.
What happens if she was guilty and her stomach falls apart? And then
well, that's what it says in the text, but we don't know that it actually happens,
no,
right?
No, and after that, do they get divorced? Like, what's the...
Yeah, certainly, or unless she dies, right? So now the question is, how do we understand what it is that actually happens to her?
Right.
So in the text, it says those things happen to her body. The assumption is that that means that she dies, and then the Mishnah goes on to say, well, let's see, she's guilty, but she doesn't die. Then there's this explanation, that explanation. She has a schut, and the schut could last for a couple of years, and either that means she totally dodges the bullet and is saved, or else that she has a schut, but it lasts for a limited amount of time, and after that amount of time, she dies, and she just continues to, like, her health declines. So it's like a slow version of this, perhaps. But we just don't have the information. We don't know what her end is here. And one of the curious things about Sota, which sort of helps us in a way and hinders us in the same way, is, you know, when you talk about a particular practice or a particular halacha, so you often have stories. The Gemara will tell stories about it. This guy was a Nazir, and this guy brought a Korban, and this guy was Chayav Mita, and this is how they killed him. And they have some traditional recollections going back several generations, people saying, this is what I heard from my father, this is what I remember. I remember about the Beit HaMikdash, I remember about Yom Kippur and the Beit HaMikdash, I remember about Korban Pesach, and they pass it down, we have it. We do not have one story in the literature about a Sota. So we don't have a story that says, Hahi itata, there was such a woman who was suspected and came in and she drank and, you know, she didn't die right away, but a week later she blew up or anything. We don't have anything like that. So we don't really have anything to go on, which on the one hand hinders us because it means we don't really have a handle on what this means. On the other hand, it helps us because it gives us all the room in the world to speculate about what it might mean. Now, on the other hand, there is a statement in the Mishnah, which is part of the Mishnayot at the end of Sota, which are very appropriate for summertime, because they describe sort of the fall of religious, I wouldn't call it power, but religious seriousness or religious significance or religious commitment, really that's the word, a religious commitment towards the end of Bayit Sheni. And it says, you know, that X amount of years before the destruction, the Sanhedrin moved out of the Lishkat HaGazit. And X years before the destruction, X happened. So one of the things that happened is Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, we're going to stop doing the Sota ceremony. Why? Because there's so much adultery going on that it's not effective. Now, what does that mean? If you think about it, it's a little strange. Because if it's really effective in a way of saying that she's going to get well, so then more women get like zapped. If you're saying, on the other hand, it's not effective because it's really all about deterrence and that's not working, and you got a different story. But the statement itself implies that there really were Sota stuff going on and that he put a stop to it.
And that would
explain why we don't have anybody saying Hahi Itata, because there was already a gap before the destruction when they weren't doing it anymore. But you'd still expect to have some tradition out there saying, you know, this guy's great-great-great-grandmother's sister went through this, and we have a story in the family about what happened when she drank the water, right? So it's a little strange that there's a total absence of that. But in any case, that's what we have here. So there is a school of thought out there that says that the entire thing is psychosomatic. Now, psychosomaticism is something that is real. We all understand that the body can be told by the mind what to do, and the mind can tell you you're sick and your body will get sick. Your mind can tell you you're better and you can heal yourself through strong enough thinking. We all understand that. But it's a little bit of a stretch to say that you're going to have a very particular kind of consequence, and everybody who's guilty ends up psychosomatically coming up with those symptoms, and anybody who's not guilty doesn't, considering how many people there are walking around who are not guilty of anything but have guilty consciences, and vice versa. And, you know, you could have some other sort of manifestation. So it's a little bit strange to say that, which leaves us with the last option. So it's not the last option. Yeah, Bill, you want to ask?
Okay. So we don't have any stories of stories of what happened to a woman who drank the water.
Right.
So here's my theory.
Well, let's see what's going on before we get to the theory. I'm just trying to throw out the possibilities.
Well, I think I know what's going on.
Well, let's see in the text. We'll see what's happening. Good question. Yeah.
In the same way, like, for example, you can't charge interest, they create a crucible in order to get around it, as opposed to...
Well, the heteristico, yeah. Crucible is something else, but okay. 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 There's an end around.
What's the end around Soto without saying we're going to stop the...
What do you mean, what's the end around?
Meaning, the Torah presumes that these are going to be low incidence rate or high incidence rate, but there's a function called Sota that you're drinking the water if someone suspects. It doesn't talk about whether there's a lot of people doing it or a few people doing it. So all of a sudden Rabbi Yochanan comes and says, well, we're not going to do it anymore. How do you do that?
So why? I'm not sure what the question is.
You couldn't say we're not going to start charging interest now. You had to create this.
No, but there's a huge difference. Is that commerce is something that everybody regularly engages in, and the Torah regulates commerce, and one of the ways it regulates it is Shemitah, another way is it interest, etc. And that's something that we need to deal with. This is something we never need to deal with. You could just convince every husband to not be paranoid and to not do anything until there's actually testimony.
That's what? It's not realistic.
Why is it not realistic?
Because the Torah is telling you that this is going to happen.
No, the Torah is telling you, if this happens, this is what you do. But that doesn't mean that you have any responsibility to do it. There's no responsibility for any parent whose son, who is exactly that age and has drunk this much wine and this much meat, that they have to take him to the Beit Din and have the kid stoned. You could have never happened in history. As a matter of fact, that's one opinion in Chazal, that it never did happen.
But you're saying that the Torah would encourage you to remain in a marriage where you feel... that your wife was...
No, right, you could divorce. But I'm not sure why... I don't get the question.
But the Torah...
Why can't Rabbi Yochanan...
Because you get divorced where you don't know if the person did it, but if you go through the social experience, the Torah is giving you a way to say, now you know.
Or you could just... But I'm not sure. Let's say that there is no such ceremony.
Yes, forgive me.
Go ahead.
This whole ceremony is about trying to reconcile... A marriage with
maybe.
A suspicion.
Maybe.
Nothing happens when you drink the thing.
Maybe.
And because nothing happens, the husband should go home and feel, oh, his wife is innocent.
Maybe.
And that's the whole basis of the theory.
Maybe. Again, we don't know that that's true. The Torah doesn't describe it that way. I'm saying I agree with you that that's a possibility. And that's what a couple of years ago I suggested here, that it's about mollification. But we have to just say maybe because we don't know. The Torah doesn't say, listen, guys, I'm going to tell you a secret here, which is none of this works, and it's all there to make you feel good. So we don't know. But I'm not sure why there's a problem with saying we're not going to do this practice anymore. We also said, Jason's question, I could say very easily that you'd do the same thing with Avdu. We just don't have Avadim anymore. We've kind of, shall we say, outgrown it. So maybe people have outgrown this kind of paranoia. I don't know.
Let me speak to that.
But let me take you to the last possibility here, because we got to get around to the new piece, right? The way that it's typically understood, although there are statements in Chazal that support the first two approaches, because, for instance, the very famous statement in Chazal, which is that God wanted his own name to be erased in order to bring peace between a man and his wife, seems to indicate that the entire purpose, as Bill's saying, that the entire purpose of the ceremony is to bring peace to the household and to have him put his fears down, which may mean that in any case, it's not going to happen. And even if it did happen, even if there was, how do you call it, was really an affair, since the husband will now be convinced that it didn't happen, they'll resume and hopefully the wife will have a scare in her or won't do it again, etc. That's possibility one. Possibility two is that it's about deterrence, because the Mishnah in Sota says that all of the women are chayiv to come and watch her be degraded so that they will be scared by that and won't entertain the thoughts of having an affair because they'll see what will happen to them. So you have both statements in Chazal indicating these other sort of motivations besides actually judging the woman. However, the simplest way to read the text, maybe, and I say maybe because there's a word in here that we have to look at differently. The simplest way to read the text is that if the woman committed an affair, then she'll drink this water and Something bad will happen to her. Die, not that. Well, something will happen to her, and that thing that will happen will be right around the genitalia, which, of course, is very, you know, poetic justice. On the other hand, if she's not guilty, then she'll drink the water, nothing will happen to her, and then everybody will see that she's okay, which means something very weird. It means that this is the only circumstance that we have where God says, I'm staying in the Beit Din, and I'm going to judge, which is weird. It's weird because of two things. It's weird because of a lot of things. It's weird in light of the fact that we have, of course, Lo Bashamayim Hi, as a general rule of God's involvement with law. But we have another problem here, which is, why this law more than anything else? Why don't we say that if somebody's accused of secretly trying to get people to do Avodah Zarah, a masit, and he denies it, that the person has to stand there with a stick and or a fire pan, that would be nice, and put some Torah in it, and if he's guilty, the fire will come down and burn him up. Why not do that? And we don't find this in any other area of law except this one. Right? That's problem one. Problem two, of course, is that why then go through the whole ritual that looks a little bit, sorry for saying it, a little magical? The water and the dirt and the ink. Why not just say a woman stands there and swears, the coin says to her, if you're guilty, you'll die. She stands there and boom! Lightning hits her. In other words, why introduce all of these weird things that seem to be magical and turn this thing into an incantation, which is playing exactly against the Torah's interest in trying to defeat paganism? All right? So, these fellows, Amzalam and Yonai, I marked them at the bottom, made a very interesting suggestion. And the more I think about it, the more I like it. And then after I tell you, then you'll tell me if you buy it or if you have another thing you want to share. What does the coin put into the water?
Is that the scarlet?
So what does it say? Token Pasuk Yudzayin. First, she takes a ceramic pot, right, or kli, puts water from the kior. He takes dirt from the floor of the Mishkan and puts it in. All right? And then he takes the parsha, writes it down, and dissolves it in there, and has her drink it. What is the water called? They're called Mayim Marim, bitter waters. And the bitter waters come in and are Marim, are cursing. There's a play on words, Marim, Marim. Okay. I don't know how long it's been since you've had dirt water. I don't know, little kids drink dirt. Dirt water tastes pretty icky, but it doesn't taste bitter. Bitter is not a word you use for water with dirt in it. And the ink's not going to make it bitter either. But there's yet something else to look at. If you look at Pasuk Yod Zayin very carefully, there's a word which I believe is extra. Umin ha'afar, the second half, asher yihiyah b'karka mishkan. The word yihiyah is unnecessary. The Pasuk should have said, umin ha'afar b'karka mishkan, from the dirt that's on the floor of the mishkan. Asher Yevakar Kamishkan makes it sound like you've got this particular dirt that you got to put there and have it prepared, and then you go and pick it up from the Karkamishkan and put it in. So what is Afar? And that, by the way, everything's going to rest on this. What is Afar? Afar we typically translate as dirt. That's probably what the translation on the back says, or dust. Okay, but typically Afar is dirt or dust. Sometimes Afar replaces Afar and becomes ashes, typically. Not always, though. Take a look at Pasuk 2 on the page, which is two Pasukim from a passage in Eov about mining. And in it, he has the following statement. Barzel me'afar yukach. Barzel, which is iron, is taken from afar. So that you could easily say means you mine it from the earth. But then you have this phrase that refers to afrod zahav. What's afrod zahav? Why would you describe that? Afrod zahav? See it?
Maybe afrot is actually an object?
So, no, afrot means afar of. Afar of. Afrot zahav means? So, gold dust. So, these fellows make an interesting suggestion, which then has tremendous implications. And that is that what this afar is, which he particularly brings and prepares and puts in the floor of the Mishkan, is copper dust. Now, it happens to be the case that copper dust, when ingested, impacts on fertility. And I mentioned this on Shabbat, and somebody who comes to the shiur, who's a doctor and quite a researcher, emailed me on Sunday with an entire report about the impact of copper dust on implantation. And if you were to ingest a certain amount of copper dust, it would render you infertile for a while.
For a while.
For a while. We don't know. However, this is the more interesting thing. If you were to ingest the proper amount of copper dust, it would cause tremendous cramps and nausea and spontaneous abortion. Hold on a second. Spontaneous abortion. Which means that maybe what's happening here is that the Kohen is making a mix, and it's not magical, it's chemical, is making a mix that when she drinks it, if indeed she is with child, that child's going to be aborted. Now take a look at the psukim, and you'll see how this actually comes out. Start from the beginning, on top. Daberu b'nei Yisrael v'marta lehem, the top. Ish ki tiste ishto u'ma'ala v'mal. If a woman strays from her husband and violates against him, v'shachav ish ota shichvat zera, and a man lies with her, shichvat zera, which means there's two different things that have happened here.
Right.
I mean, they're the same. One of them is she had an affair. The second thing is she got pregnant. And throughout, there's this double sign of message.
But it doesn't say pregnant. It's just saying...
But shichvat zera.
Well, if she was pregnant, then...
Okay, so now, that means that the context of this law would be that the husband, we would certainly hope, has not had relations with his wife for a couple months. He was away, he comes back, he suspects. And what is it that he really suspects?
Someone else.
Now, she doesn't see she's pregnant. If he saw she was pregnant, that would be the end of the road. That's the best evidence you have. Right? So what is it the husband really doesn't want?
The baby.
He really doesn't want to be raising somebody else's kid. And so the husband would be motivated now to come and say, okay, we'll do the ceremony.
Have they ever used this?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's the interesting thing, is in Keni, the Kenim, you know, Chovab's descendants,
yeah.
In South Canaan, we have records of them actually using this both as a prophylactic and as an a morning after pill kilu, which creates that, which would then mean something really interesting, is that this woman's coming. God's not getting involved in the court. That's not what's happening. God doesn't get involved in the court. This is not a deterrent, although it acts as a deterrent, and it also acts as shalom bayit, because if indeed she comes out clean, then the husband, you know, can rest assured. It's not going to really tell him she didn't have the affair, but that's not the thing that's really driving him. Remember, this is a drastic move on his part. So it's very likely this drastic move was actually occasioned by something that he thinks much bigger than that, which is that she's going to be carrying somebody else's child. She's clearly very early in this process. Maybe she doesn't even know she's pregnant. If she were, she probably wouldn't drink it. She probably said, I'm not going to drink, and that's it. But in the meantime, she does. Now, what does it say happens to her if she drinks and she's guilty? It exactly describes an abortion. Spontaneous abortion, a miscarriage. That's what it describes. And so, now what's the interesting thing is, v'im torahi, towards the end it says, if she's torah, v'nikta v'nizra azara. Listen to that word. She will become cleansed, and then she will have seed. So the interesting thing is that if you ingest this copper dust, it takes a while for it to flush out of the system before you can have kids again. V'nikta v'nizra azara. So if she drinks it and she has this thing happen, we know she was pregnant. If the husband's been away for a few months, it's somebody else's kid. If on the other she drinks it, nothing happens, she's not pregnant. And then
Her having kids? Because isn't there a story that when a couple were not able to conceive, they would go through this process in order to.
No, you're thinking about Chana, and that's
what happened to a woman who became pregnant,
yeah.
Noticeably. Her husband's away. They don't kill her, do they?
No.
The baby's a mom's.
They have to get divorced, and she loses her ketubah, but that's it.
That's it.
You can't, because you don't have testimony to what happened. You have to have witnesses.
So, but why does the Torah say she's going to get pregnant afterwards?
It doesn't necessarily mean she's going to get pregnant. What do you mean? V'niktav v'nizra azera. Then when she becomes cleansed, then she could again kilu.
Okay.
Right? So now this possibility, and I understand it's a new possibility. When I first read it, like I said, I'm saying it took me 2 weeks to be able to internalize it, but it actually, this is the part that I like the most, and it's not in their article. This is the part that I like the most because it sheds light on a very troubling story that I've lost sleep over in the past, and now I can sleep. Right? And that is a story in Breishit. That's a story in Breishit. Right? In Breishit, we have the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Okay? Now, Tamar is Yehuda's daughter-in-law. Yehuda's son dies. So Yehuda says to his other son, do Yibum. He doesn't do Yibum the right way. He doesn't want to do Yibum. And he gets killed too. And so what does Yehuda say to Tamar? Well, the next son is too young. Go back and wait for him to grow up. But inside he says, I'm never going to let her name my kids. She kills husbands. So I'm not going to let her. So she's in limbo. Because she's still tied to the family as Yivama, but he won't let them do Yibum. Time comes, and famously with the story, is that Yehuda's wife dies. She's looking for some sexual companionship. So Tamar goes, and she dresses up like a harlot. And Yehuda hires her and has sex with her. And doesn't have anything to pay her with. I left my wallet, my other pants. And so he gives her some simanim, right? Their sash, etc. And then the next day he sends the payment to get his simanim back, which are ID cards, basically, ID markers, and she's gone. And nobody knows where she is. She was never there, etc. Okay, so that's kind of the end of that piece of the road. In the meantime, Yehuda is told the following. And here's the part I want to show you. Vayikim ishtosh chadashim, bottom of the page. Vayugav Yehuda limar zanta tamar kalatacha. So what do they tell Yehuda? The Tamar had relations. V'hineh al iznunim, and now she's pregnant. What does Yehuda say as a result? Hotziuha v'tisaref. What does that mean? What does that mean? Take her out and burn her. Why burn her? Why? She's a single woman. Why burn her? Okay, so she should be having relations inside the family, but she's single. She's not married to anybody. Where'd the burning come from? So the interesting question is, what does Srefa actually mean in Tanakh? Who is it that we know who got burned up in Tanakh? Look at source 3. Who got burned up in Tanakh?
Oh, well, the two sons.
Nadav and Avihu.
Yeah.
How did they get burned up?
At the Mishkan.
How did they get burned up?
Well, the fire came out.
Where'd the fire go? Where'd it go? It came from above. Where'd it go?
It went right out the doors.
What? And where'd it go as far as they're concerned? So Chazal say it went into them, right?
Yeah.
But you know why Chazal say it went into them? Because if it didn't go into them, what happens to them? If it doesn't go into them, the fire just hits them, what happens to them? They're toast,
yeah.
Right? And if they're toast, they're not a body anymore. In which case, there's no issue of tumah. And what's the first thing Moshe says? Get the bodies out because of tumah. So what's the assumption of what happened to them? The fire went inside of them, burned their insides out. And the bodies are still there as tumah. Which, by the way, is interesting because how do we actually do Srefa as an execution? We don't burn anybody. The crucible is a myth. What do? I mean, a crucible might not be a myth, but it's not ours. What do? We actually pour hot lead down the throat. Srefa is internal. Aha. If Srefa is internal, then now look at the story of Yehuda and Tamar again. What is Yehuda saying to do?
Burn out the baby.
Which is? The give her some of this stuff.
Yeah.
In other words, what Yehuda says, I'm not kill her. But rather,
kill the baby.
Because this baby is some mamzer.
Right.
And then Tamar says, what? Ooh, does anybody recognize these signs? Oh, oops, my baby. And that's,
it's
of course.
Also, so what's the significance of the 3 months?
Oh, because in that case, they actually saw she was pregnant. Right? They saw she was pregnant, and so they brought her, and so Yehuda's judgment was, uh-huh. We've got to get rid of the kid. And that, so I think that's what Hotzio Tzisaref, which, by the way, makes the Yehuda's judgment here much, much milder. Much milder, because if you think about it, for Yehuda to say, Hotzio Tzisaref actually killed Tamar, when he's the reason that Tamar can't be with anybody, is abhorrent. But now when he's saying Hotzio Tzisaref, means, okay, this is what we have to do as a woman, you know, like, you know, has got pregnant with somebody outside of the family, so we got to,
well,
you
know, Tzisaref. Well, this is compelling with the Noah story with the sons.
Yeah. Good, yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you...
But I can't believe you're sleeping again. That's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm sleeping a little bit more, because now I'm not so bothered by Yehuda's behavior. In any case, hopefully it's a little bit of a different... It's not a little, it's a very different take. And so, then I'll be honest with you, the more I think about it, the more I concentrate on it, the more it actually fits well, not only within the parsha, but making sense. And now it sells... What?
Where is it published?
This is published in JSOT.